Mr. Lichtenstein, we'll hear from you.
May it please the court, I think we need to start with discussing how the Ford and Rector cases from the state Supreme Court affect this case. I think the primary impact of those two cases is procedural. Both cases do recognize that the trial court has discretion to dispense with a Shrek hearing, although the Rector case does suggest that it's a smart thing for the trial court to do, to have an evidentiary hearing anytime there are some serious questions about the reliability of the proffered expert opinion. I think Ford turned out to be a much more important case in its effect on this case, and that's because in that case there were two excluded doctors' opinions. Most importantly, one of those went to an alternative theory of causation, and the trial court held a non-evidentiary hearing looking at doctors' affidavits and depositions and arguments of counsel, and then made an exclusionary ruling based on those hearings. I think Ford stands for two important propositions.
One, Mr. Lichtenstein, there's some background noise. Can you maybe get closer to the microphone or speak up?
Okay, apologize.
I think that might be the air conditioning system, so I don't know if there's anything we can do about it. I'm sorry.
Okay, I'll just try to speak up then. Two important points about the Ford opinion. First, the trial court's discretion is not boundless. The reviewing court will take a look at it. And the second one is that where the court does not hold an evidentiary Shrek hearing, the deference to the trial court's assessments of credibility of the witnesses, of the proffered expert, are not really a factor. And so it's easier for this court, as the reviewing court, to look anew at the trial court's record on the Shrek motion. So where the defense suggested in this case that there was, once the trial court decided there was no need for a hearing, we should have asked for more specific findings, I think maybe that's valid in certain cases, but not this one. I think it very much limits that kind of a...
Counsel, let me ask you this about the Rector decision, now that it's been handed down by the Supreme Court. After Rector, is there any published opinion in which a trial court has been reversed for abuse of discretion for admitting expert testimony without making an adequate inquiry and specific findings?
Nothing I'm aware of, but of course it hasn't been very long, so...
Well, that's a good point, but I mean, even before it, because I thought, when I read the briefs, the argument was, well, the Court of Appeals Rector decision is the only opinion in which that's occurred, and then the Court of Appeals decision was reversed by the Supreme Court, and so now I'm asking if you agree that situation, there no longer is a standing good law case on the records in Colorado in which that has occurred.
In which the trial courts included evidence that should have been excluded and granted a new trial. Is that, am I understanding your question?
The trial court was reversed for abuse of discretion for admitting expert testimony without making an adequate inquiry and specific findings.
I don't know cases like that, but I can't imagine anything in the Rector opinion that prohibits that. I think the Rector opinion was decided on very narrow grounds, which was that the appellant had not raised a sufficient Shrek challenge, had not really directed the court's attention to the argument. Clearly, in this case, where we did 16 pages of Shrek briefing, and there's all kinds of, there's the doctor's report and his deposition, I don't think we have that situation. But again, I think to say that there's that the trial court has boundless discretion is to misread both Rector and Ford. So anyway, on to the main event here, which is the actual opinions of Dr. Moe that we're challenging in this case. The testimony of Dr. Moe failed on just about every count of the reliability analysis, of the entire analysis, rather, of Shrek. Starting with qualifications, he had no expertise in complex regional pain syndrome. He had no expertise in physical medicine. Nevertheless, he was permitted to give opinions about whether Ms. House's symptoms were explained by CRPS. He was
permitted to talk about her treatment for prior injuries and whether they were indicated as a matter of physical medicine. He was even permitted to give an opinion that no expert, let alone a psychiatrist, is permitted to give under existing case law, which is that a car accident that's caused by an impact below a certain level can't cause physical symptoms in this case.
Mr. Lichtenstein, how do you pronounce your name?
Lichtenstein, thank you.
Lichtenstein. Didn't Dr. Moe say he rendered no opinion with regard to CRS?
He said that, but at the same time, he spent a lot of time talking about how CRPS charted this strange course and how, in his assessment, after looking at all these medical records, there were some serious doubts as to whether she had CRPS. So, that's where, it's one thing to admit that you don't have the expertise, and it's another thing to go into the opinions that are based on that lack of expertise.
What's your reaction to the notion that he testified on the basis of psychiatry as to pain syndromes generally, that there are psychological and psychiatric causes of pain, which includes, the pain disorder, et cetera?
Well, that's general testimony. That's one thing. But he was getting into specifics in Ms. Houck's case, and he was positing this basically three-part possible diagnosis that he couldn't make because he could not rule out the possibility and the fact in this case that there was an actual physical ailment.
Well, let's focus on that for a second. It seems to me, do you quibble with the categories? One is that a possible diagnosis is in fact a pain syndrome, and the other is that there's possibly, factitious disorder, and malingering.
Yes.
Right. And now, as I understand Dr. Moe's testimony, he did not place her in any of these categories. He just said you should be aware that there are these three categories.
That's true, but that's where you get to the prejudice side of the equation, because he had absolutely no basis to rule out pain disorder among those three possibilities.
And didn't he admit that?
I assume he did, but to touch on the other two at all, when there's no basis for those are the ones that should have been ruled out. He testified that factitious disorder is an extremely rare condition. He wasn't finding that. He testified he did no tests for malingering. There are a lot of, he had no diagnostic tools that he used, like DSM-4. He rejected those tools.
But those would have been necessary if he were to have placed her in one of those categories, but to raise as a general matter that there are these other categories, that they are possibilities for someone claiming to have suffered from a pain syndrome. Well, I don't understand why that isn't relevant and helpful.
Well, it's relevant under 401, but under 403, there's a huge amount of prejudice that goes with that, because he's basically raising the scepter that this is a person that can be lying. That's what he's basically putting on his lab coat, and he's saying, even though he says, as a psychiatrist, he has no special expertise in this area, he's going to throw it out. He's going to throw out this whole medical history, and he says it's for other people to draw the conclusions.
So your primary complaint as to that opinion really then rests on 403?
Well, it also rests on the liability, again, because he was not competent to exclude the physical explanation that would account for the symptoms, the CRPS condition. And no other doctor, by the way, went there and said that they were going to rule out CRPS.
So I guess I'm trying to understand your argument about reliability. So is your premise that unless he said, I rule out CRPS, then his other testimony had no reliability, that's a foundational requirement for the reliability of everything else he said?
Yeah, I mean, that's one aspect of reliability. He's got to have some methodology to get to this three-part analysis where he posits these three different syndromes. And I think he dwelt quite a bit on the other two diagnoses that both involved essentially misleading care providers and misleading the jury with no basis on to address those. And I mean, the case is mostly about methodology. I mean, what he's doing is he's kind of starting off in space somewhere without having a basis for saying, I can rule out RSD, and therefore one of these three things is going on. And then he spent quite a bit of time talking about those three conditions. He had tools that he could have used to do some kind of differential diagnosis as to those conditions, and he completely ignored them. So it's one thing to talk about this in general terms, but then to bring them home and talk about the plaintiff in those terms, he just didn't have a basis to do that.
Could a psychiatrist come in without having examined a particular plaintiff and talk about DSM-4, talk about possible diagnoses that exist under DSM-4, talk about considerations in symptomology, and then just not give an opinion, but basically educate the jury on possible causes of subjective reports of pain? Couldn't a psychiatrist do that?
That may be possible as a matter of reliability, but you also have to look at the other Schreck factors. For example, usefulness. Is it helpful for an expert in a case under these facts? And you have to tie the expert opinion to the facts of the case. Does it add something to this particular case? Again, where just about every other expert, including hearsay experts whose opinions were brought in, said that either she had COPS or couldn't decide, and that's only in the case of one other testifying defense expert. So we have to key it into the facts of the case, and we have to look at whether it's helpful, and we have to look at whether it's relevant. And again, as I cited in the brief, there are cases that say that any kind of opinion that suggests some special provenance to impart to the jury whether a particular party is lying, that really has to be scrutinized by the court. So I think that bears on usefulness, it bears on relevance, and I think it even goes back to qualifications.
And the standard of review is abuse of discretion?
It is, okay. Absolutely. Turning back to the usefulness point, I think it's one of the things that was especially unhelpful about Dr. Moore's testimony is that he did this very broad review of all of Ms. Houck's medical records. And you have to ask, how is this a psychiatrist's job to do that? And especially, how is it his job to do that, lay it out there, and not reach any kind of a conclusion? Why him? And he admits that's a problem, because when he talks about the symptoms she had before the subject car accident, he says that even though he found those symptoms meaningful, quote, his expertise as a psychiatrist does not make them any more meaningful than they would be otherwise. That's right from his deposition. So that's a problem. And of course, as I said, the prejudice factor is very big, because it's a gratuitous window into this particular doctor's skepticism about her treatment, physical medicine treatment from the prior accident. It's inadmissible character evidence, and again, it comes down to him basically calling her a liar.
Explain to me this concept of inadmissible character evidence. What are you talking about there? What character is being brought in?
Well, this notion of being symptom prone. There's no psychiatric evidence given of that. There's no definition of that term. It's basically something that was pulled out of thin air. There's no methodological support for it. And so basically he's saying this is a person who's making up symptoms.
Now, counsel, am I correct in saying or in believing that you did not actually make that argument in your motion, your Schreck motion?
No, I think I did.
Really? I do not. In reviewing it, I did not get the sense that you complained that symptom proneness is not a definable, quantifiable medical condition.
Well, I know I mentioned symptom proneness several times, and I referenced it as being a essentially a cover for kind of an impressionistic analysis. This would be at page 18, for example, of the Schreck motion, where he's what I say is that he's basically disguising his analysis of symptoms as being symptom prone, when in fact he's not qualified to give that kind of opinion.
Yes, what comes through clearly in as to that point and many others is this overarching argument that because he is primarily a psychiatric or is entirely a psychiatric expert, that he lacks the qualifications to render an opinion about what could, about factors that could confound the diagnosis of a physical condition.
Well, I'm not saying he lacks the expertise as to all factors, but the ones that he pulled out are not psychiatric conditions or terms or notions. These are things that he, as far as I'm concerned, as far as I can tell, he basically either made up or refused to define.
So you're saying that it's not a peer-reviewed, tested, accepted diagnosis?
Or any of the other factors that come out in Schreck or the other cases, that federal or state cases that pull out these factors. I'm out of time. Thank you.
Good afternoon. I'm Mark Gauthier. I represent David Simmons. Let me pick up on the Eicher decision. Dr. Moe opined in trial on his deposition that all of his diagnoses or attempt to diagnose her problem were conditional diagnoses. And he went to great lengths in 50-page report that Judge Speer had before him to explain why it was a conditional diagnosis. It is true Dr. Moe never testified that she has CRPS. He did say she has those symptoms and those qualities, but he would defer to the experts who have that knowledge. Dr. Moe is a medical doctor. He was trained in medicine throughout his training before becoming a forensic psychiatrist. That's in the record of the trial court. Judge Speer had before him the deposition transcript of Dr. Moe, his 50-page report, his CV, and our briefs. The only thing that Judge Speer didn't have is a hearing. And under Schreck, a hearing or a Schreck request does not always require a hearing or a Schreck analysis. Plaintiff did argue that Dr. Moe didn't conduct any cognitive tests, battery of psychological tests, or refer the plaintiff out for those procedures. So we don't have any testing done by Dr. Moe, as Judge Speer pointed out in his rulings, that can be replicated or tested or scrutinized. So Judge Speer didn't conduct a Schreck hearing or analysis. As in Eicher and Rector, they talked about the fact that can you replicate this procedure during vaginal delivery to cause a brachial plexus injury. That was the discussion about the experts in that case. Was it induced by the doctor's pressure or by natural uterine pressure? So what the trial court struggled in Eicher was, how can we replicate that testing? It would be unethical to do that. So the distinction is that there was no testing for Judge Speer to scrutinize and have a hearing. There's also Dr. Woodcock, who proffered his neuropsychological testimony as a differential diagnosis. And differential diagnosis is a diagnosis by elimination. And he testified about that at trial. And in the Eicher court, they also recognized that the experts' opinions were differential diagnoses, which essentially is what Dr. Moe was proffering, that a conditional diagnosis is, in psychiatry, a diagnosis by elimination. He was trying to articulate all the things that could possibly be causing her problems from a psychological perspective. He does look at the physical medicine of it as well. He articulates that pretty well in his testimony. And you have to understand that all the doctors agreed that the plaintiff, Ms. Houck, had problems with psychological problems that pre-existed the accident and then manifested themselves after the accident in additional physical complaints.
Now, Counselor, would you focus for a second on this testimony that she is, that the plaintiff here is symptom prone? What is the relevance of that testimony?
Good question. Symptom proneness, the doctor pointed out, specific instances since our accident that she was having pain She was experiencing pain beyond the normal that you would see for that injury. For example, he said she hurt her ankle stepping off a curb. She thought she fractured her ankle. The x-rays and objective testing said, no, you didn't, but she wore a boot for about 8 months. So she was having an overreaction to certain stimuli that shouldn't create such a reaction.
And Dr. Moore used that as an example in his testimony?
He did.
Okay, and explain to me how that's relevant, because I'm hearing so far just another way of describing what we used to call in the old days an eggshell plaintiff.
That's a good point. The reason it's relevant in this case is because Dr. Woodcock made several diagnoses, including pain disorder with physical and psychological conditions, panic attacks, high pain despite treatment, which is symptom prone, and that's similar to Dr. Moe's analysis of symptom proneness. So I guess, as Dr. Moe finally said in cross-examination by Mr. Lichtenstein, is differential diagnosis is probably a more articulate way of describing what he was seeing. So it's relevant in that he's rebutting Dr. Woodcock's, or supporting Dr. Woodcock's opinion about her condition. She was having somatoform features, which you have to question whether they're fictitious or malingering. So Dr. Woodcock was even recognizing that she was having, what did he describe as, maladaptive coping and regression. Maladaptive coping, he gave an example of, he would talk to her and she would revert to baby talk or revert to an age that she didn't present as. I mean, as a young child rather than the middle 20s that she was. So it was relevant in that respect, Your Honor, because Dr. Moe was picking up on the same things that Dr. Woodcock was picking up on.
But there was no evidence, was there, that someone who is symptom prone is more likely to develop this syndrome spontaneously?
I would say there was no evidence of that. What the experts agreed upon, including the expert I retained, Dr. Smith, and they had six experts who says she has CRPS, but they all agreed on the fact that CRPS can come on spontaneously for minor impact, surgery, unknown causes. So even the doctors, although they say she had CRPS, had to admit that it's not necessarily caused by this trauma. But two of the doctors, Dr. Schultz and Dr. Brewer being the preeminent local authority on CRPS, associated the CRPS to the accident. So although they looked at all the records, that they associated it to the accident. But to say that someone who's just symptom prone is going to later develop CRPS, I don't think there was evidence of that.
And what did Dr. Moe say about being symptom prone? I mean, how does one determine whether someone's in the category of being symptom prone? This is not an actual medical condition or a psychological condition that people speak about, is it?
Correct. And Dr. Woodcock and Dr. Moe also, and Dr. Laub, who testified in rebuttal to Dr. Moe, agreed that DSM-IV is a guideline. It's not the gospel, if you will, and everybody has to follow it. It's a guideline, so experts at least have a baseline that they can relate to each other. I'm sorry, I forgot your question.
Well, the question is, what makes reliable his opinion that she is symptom prone?
Well, he did have the advantage. Dr. Moe had the advantage of looking at all the records. Dr. Woodcock did not have that advantage, although he was the treating neuropsychiatrist. He saw the plaintiff, I think, three or four times, issued about eight reports, but he didn't have all the records submitted to him, like Dr. Moe. So Dr. Moe did go through her history and the plaintiff's history and noticed in 02 she had an accident. In August of 05, she had an incident where she pounded her fists on the deck late at night and hurt her hands. If you recall, her CRPS did go into her right hand. He was just picking up on her personality disorder, like Dr. Woodcock did, and enhancing the additional elements of that personality disorder or pain disorder that Dr. Woodcock was addressing. I mean, he was essentially agreeing with Dr. Woodcock that she has psychological conditions, and Dr. Woodcock diagnosed a personality disorder.
Counsel, if I can, on the symptom proneness, like my colleague who's heard of the eggshell plaintiff, I've also heard of being accident prone. This symptom proneness, is this a terminology created by Dr. Moe? Is it in the literature? What's the methodology behind it?
I would say it's not in the literature. It is a term Dr. Moe, I guess, developed in his deposition and maintained that theme. I think he mentioned it in his 50-page report. But the methodology behind it, I think, is we're splitting hairs here. It may be called something else, like Dr. Woodcock called it, a pain disorder or maladaptive behavior. So it's just a different, if you will, twist on the same term, but I think psychiatrists agree fundamentally what it is, just called it different things. Does that answer your question?
And then there was no testing on the malingering piece of it, is that correct?
That's correct. Dr. Woodcock had brought it up initially, and he didn't test for it. It kind of emanates from somatoform disorder. It could be fictitious, meaning you adopt an illness role, or malingering, meaning you're adopting a role for secondary gain. Dr. Woodcock did not perform any testing for that, and neither did Dr. Moe. In fact, Dr. Moe said, these are things you must consider. I'm not diagnosing fictitious disorder or malingering, and one is intentional, one is not. And he went through a great explanation of how he's not going to question someone's intent, because how do you measure that?
When does conditional diagnosis sort of cross over into improper speculation by an expert witness?
In this case, I would say that the authoritative people on the psychiatric issues, which appear to be the focus here, use DSM-IV as a guideline. So there are criteria to meet DSM-IV diagnoses. I think if you can match two or three of the criteria, you don't meet the actual diagnosis, so you're just making a conditional diagnosis. She has two of the three traits. So I don't think it pushes the limit, but a psychiatrist being who they are, unless it matches those completely or they see those symptoms, can't make the diagnosis. So I think it's it doesn't borderline on inappropriate, they're just explaining why they can't make that distinctive diagnosis. In this case, the second issue, I not that I prioritize them, but the jury selection and the claim that Mr. Ha was inappropriately not let go for cause. As I said in my brief, the voir dire selection involved plaintiff's counsel talking about all they have to be is more right than wrong. Well, that's not the definition of their burden of proof. And I pointed that out in my voir dire. Mr. Hott, as well as four other prospective jurors, asked Mr. Lichtenstein, can you use a different word than right and wrong, or different words? And he couldn't do that by just saying the burden of proof is more probable than not. So other jurors had the same fundamental, like, I don't want to say fundamental, but they questioned more right than wrong. But the clear thing is that Mr. Hott never made a representation that he couldn't follow the law or that he was biased one way or the other. I do have to apologize to you, Judge Russell, because I misspelled your case, the Mirror case, People v. Merrill, which dealt with, which dealt with challenges for cause. And in that case, the young girl who wasn't discharged for cause said, I might whip through deliberations because I'm focused on my classes. The judge said, no, that's not sufficient basis. But later in chambers, she started articulating an issue about her opinions on drug use, as well as other credibility issues, drug usage, And that's eventually what you determined was because she could not make that distinction or determination of credibility, she was not an appropriate juror, and the judge should have excused her. So we don't have that in this case.
Why isn't it a bias against defendant, against the plaintiff to say, well, if you only want a modest amount of money, then I accept your standard of more likely than not. But you want a lot of money, it needs to be a higher standard. Why isn't that an inherent bias against the plaintiff?
I don't think it's an inherent bias because at this point, we're asking these jurors to give us answers in a bubble. They don't know the facts. But what they're telling us is, you know, they're going to hold you to your standard of proof. I don't think Mr. Hott told Judge Speer that he couldn't follow the law that the court's going to give him. So I think when you look at the voir dire process in a whole, as the case law says you should, that it's not inherently biased against them or prejudicial to the plaintiff.
Was there any rehabilitation with regard to following the judge's instructions, and will you follow the judge's instructions as given, and if, et cetera?
From Judge Speer, not per se, but the first two paragraphs of my voir dire talk about burden of proof, and I read what it is and asked the jurors generally, please, I said, any questions about what I'm going to say, please raise your hand. Here's the burden of proof. Anybody have a problem finding that? Our goal is to find a fair and impartial jury. And then I think in my closing paragraph, I kind of asked that general question again. So from Judge Speer, no, but I think my voir dire kind of was rehabilitative. Thank you.
Duffy, I want to keep you for 1 second. You have explained to us why you think the court did not abuse its discretion in refusing to excuse that juror. Do you agree that if we find that there was an abuse of discretion, that we must reverse the verdict here under the McCrandall rule as set forth in Merrill and the other cases?
I don't. I think the court has discretion to say that it was harmless, and here's why. The case, there are some federal cases cited in that case that I can't articulate for you that talk about the McCracken rule that were referenced in the Marin case. But I think People v. O'Neill also addresses that question in an analytical standpoint in terms of bias of the juror. But I don't think the court automatically has to overrule that or find that that's an issue for remanding the case to the trial court.
Okay, that concludes our argument in this case, and the court thanks both counsel for their arguments. This case will be deemed submitted, and a written opinion will issue in due course.